so we'll begin with the homage to the Buddha.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa.
Okay, good. Good morning, everybody. Okay, we have been examining sutta number 38 in the middle discourses. This is the Maha Tanha Sankhaya Sutta, the greater or longer discourse on the destruction of craving. And last time I went through a detailed explanation of the formula for dependent origination according to the sequence of arising and the sequence of cessation. And now I want to take just the very last part of the sutta, which begins on page 358 with paragraph 26. Now, the way I understand this particular passage the way I understand this passage in relation to the rest of the sutta, you see, the middle part of the sutta, which we covered last week, gave a rather abstract presentation of the formula of dependent origination. So depending on ignorance, volitional formations arise. Depending on volitional formations, consciousness. From consciousness, name and form, from name and form, the six sense bases, onto contact, feeling, craving, clinging, karmically active existence, birth, then old age and death. So this is all very abstract. And now the way I understand the section beginning with paragraph 26, the purpose here is to show in concrete terms, you know, an actual experiential, biological, and psychological terms, what the formula of dependent origination is actually illustrating. It doesn't begin exactly at the beginning, but it starts off, okay, with the conditions for what is called the descent of the embryo to take place. Okay, so the text begins, the descent of the embryo takes place through the union or coming together of three things, three conditions. And now it's called here the descent of the embryo. It's a kind of, maybe you call this a metaphorical term, or it's a word used, a little, an expression used a little bit loosely. Okay, so the Pali expression here for what's translated descent of the embryo is kabas avakanti. Avakanti means descending, coming down. And the word gaba, or this is the Sanskrit garba, ordinarily can mean either the womb or the embryo. And so when the text speaks about the descent of the embryo, it doesn't mean that the embryo is actually existing someplace in outer space and then it comes down into the womb. But rather, the expression is used here somewhat metaphorically to mean that a new being becomes conceived or enters into the womb and begins the process of embryonic development. Okay, so now the Buddha mentions that three things are necessary for this descent of the embryo to take place. First, there has to be the union, that's the sexual union of the mother and the father. But if that occurs and the mother is not in season, it's not her time to conceive, and the Gandhava is not present, in this case, no descent of an embryo takes place. I'm going to go through the whole series, then I'll explain what is meant by the Gandhava, or at least what I understand is meant by the Gandhava. Okay, that's the first possibility, the first case. The second case is where there is the union of the mother and the father, and the mother is in season, she's fertile. It's her time to conceive. But the Gandhava is not present. In this case, too, no descent of the embryo takes place. So that is the second case where there's no descent of the embryo. Then the third case, when there is the union or sexual intercourse of mother and father, and the mother is in season, and the Gandhava is present. Through the union of these three things, the descent of the embryo takes place. Okay, so now the whole passage, the meaning of the whole passage hinges on the meaning of this word, which I left in the Pali, Gandhava. And this is the Sanskrit word, Gandharva. Now, the word Gandharva is used in several senses in the early Buddhist literature. The usual sense is a kind of celestial being, kind of spiritual being, or maybe we could say supernatural being, that live in forests, in trees, in fruit trees, in flowers, they're associated with flowers, fruit trees, woods. And they're somewhat like almost like semi-gods, half-divine type beings. But they're not living in the heavenly world, but in close association with the earth. And so normally we don't see them, but those who have develop the supernormal power of vision, the divine eye, are able to see the Gandharvas. Okay, another sense that the word takes, I'm not sure whether we find this in the Pali literature, but this I think becomes typical, maybe in later literature, perhaps in Mahayana sutras. Perhaps there are some precedents for this in the Pali literature. The Gandhava is a kind of celestial musician. These are the musicians in the world of the gods. Maybe if you go into the big Buddha hall and then you walk inside, you know, there's a kind of inner semicircle around the large Buddha statue, and then there are some images of the Buddhas, bodhisattvas, and then devas. And then there are some beings who are playing musical instruments. Those are probably the Gandharvas. Okay, now there's a third use of the word Gandhava or Gandharva, which occurs only in this passage. It doesn't occur elsewhere in the Pali Canon. Only in this passage and a few other passages which are similar to this. And the way I understand the use of the word here, it means a being, let us say, the form of a living being which has separated from its previous existence and is waiting around for the mother and the father to have sexual relations in order to enter into the womb and take rebirth. The texts themselves don't really give an explicit explanation of what is meant by Gandhava in this sense. But the way I've come to understand it, it's through some contemporary literature that I've read from those, there are researchers who have investigated reported cases of people with rebirth memories. And so there are some cases of people who remember their previous life not through developing special meditative powers, but somehow this memory just remains with them. And so they actually remember their previous life, what were the events happening up to the time of their death. And then, in the cases I've read, they actually experience their death from a kind of detached perspective as they're getting into the final, the last stages of their final illness. They experience it seems as though they are separating from their physical body, but they still have a sense of possessing the same physical body. But it's a kind of very subtle form of their original physical body. So they see themselves separating from the physical body, moving around the room. Usually they sort of drift up to the ceiling and then look down at themselves, maybe lying on the deathbed. They might see their relatives come and start looking at the body, trying to resuscitate the body, to get the vital organs working again. But at a certain point, it becomes too late. And so then they might see the relatives, maybe a doctor comes, takes the pulse, checks the breathing, tells something to the relatives. They see the relatives start weeping and maybe beating the ground, pulling their hair and crying out, "Ayo, ayo, how miserable we are." And in some cases, the person who's separated tries to communicate with their living relatives and tries to tell them, "I'm still here, I'm still here." And they actually experience themselves talking, but the living relatives show no response. But in one case that I read about, though the human relative showed no response, there was a dog in the room, the pet family pet. And the family pet was looking up at the ceiling and barking. But the people were completely oblivious to the presence of anybody else in the room. Okay, then maybe a few days later, they go to the cemetery, they see the funeral taking place, they can witness, the body being put into the grave or being cremated. And they're still trying to communicate, but no communication takes place. Till at a certain point, they give up on this, and then they find themselves just moving around. They have no sense of the passage of how much time is passing, no sense of place or position. It seems that they could cross over great distances just in a few seconds, And this goes on, it could be perhaps several months, several years, though it seems to them like a relatively short time, till they find themselves attracted to a particular couple. And then they hang around that couple until the couple has sexual relations. Then when that happens, they feel themselves drawn towards the woman, and then they feel themselves sort of pulled into the body of the woman, and then at that point they lose their consciousness until they take birth again. Okay, so it seems to me, this is sort of my hypothesis, that what is meant by the Gandhava is that being which has separated from its previous physical identity and is sort of moving about, waiting for the conditions, for the appropriate conditions to arise, all the right karmic conditions, people, a couple with whom they might have some karmic affinity, who are providing the right kind of economic, social conditions, cultural conditions, all of these appropriate conditions for them to reappear in human form. So when all of those conditions come together with the appropriate mother and father, then the being can take rebirth. Yeah, so this, I think, would be the way rebirth would take place in the case of a human rebirth. It could be that in the case of a heavenly rebirth or a rebirth in the hell realm, the rebirth can take place almost immediately after death, because the heavenly beings, the hell beings, are spontaneously reborn. But so that they don't depend for their rebirth upon having karmic relations with particular other beings in that realm. But in the case of a human rebirth, and presumably an animal rebirth, there have to be the appropriate conditions. And so at the time that a person dies, it's extremely unlikely that all of these right karmic conditions have come together for them to take rebirth instantaneously. So there has to be, this is my hypothesis, some kind of intermediate state in which the being is moving about or subsisting until the right karmic conditions appear. And when I tell a story about the being separated from the body, hovering about, attending its own funeral, I'm not making up stories. This is actually cases that I've read about. If you want to check this out for yourself, there's a book, it's by a British Buddhist and researcher. His name is Francis Story. And he worked together with a professor who had been at the University of Virginia. He's passed away some years ago. His name was Ian Stevenson. And together they produced or published a book called Rebirth as Doctrine and Experience. The first part gives sort of theoretical or doctrinal explanations of the Buddhist teaching on rebirth. Then the second part consists of actual case studies prepared with fairly rigorous examination of individuals who have rebirth recollections. Then Dr. Ian Stevenson has compiled quite a few larger books on collections of rebirth cases that he's investigated. One of the earliest is called 20 Cases Suggestive of Reincarnation. And then he's also compiled a collection of rebirth cases. I don't know if you're interested, you can just check out his name on the internet. Ian, then Stevenson with a V. Okay, so the way rebirth is expressed here, it's the union of the three conditions, that is the coming together or sexual relations of mother and father. The mother is fertile and the Gandhava is present. So in that case, what is called the descent of the embryo takes place. Now, what is actually meant in sort of the ultimate sense by the descent of the embryo is the arising of consciousness in the womb. It doesn't mean that the being that is reborn is fully conscious and then starts thinking, what's on TV tonight? Any interesting news on the internet? Or doesn't start thinking, what is my mommy going to prepare for dinner tonight? But it's a very, very primitive type of consciousness, perhaps corresponding to the consciousness of the one-celled organism, you know, like a protozoan, like paramecium or amoeba. Just one cell arises, but when that one cell arises, consciousness links up with it, and that is the beginning of the life, you could say, the development of life, the development of the living being, or the beginning of the embryonic process. And when consciousness links up or connects with the fertilized egg, we have simultaneously the arising of what is called nama-rupa, name and form. Because consciousness doesn't occur on its own, but when consciousness appears, whenever it arises, it brings along with it the functions of consciousness. And the main functions of consciousness are feeling, perception, and volition. And so the one-celled organism will be the rupa, the form or body. And when consciousness connects with that fertilized egg, then there will occur some kind of feeling, a very basic, very simple feeling, a pleasant, painful feeling, or neutral feeling. There will be very, very subtle perceptions taking place, very primordial perceptions. And there'll be some degree of volition or intention, especially at the moment of when consciousness links to the egg, then there will be the intention or volition of starting the new life. Okay, now as the embryo is maturing in the mother's womb, the cell is dividing and dividing and dividing. Then as the process of cell division goes on, over time, the very simple sense organs start to emerge in the embryo of the fetus. Even at the moment of conception, we have what is called technically the body base. So the one cell fertilized egg, which is connected with consciousness, is now functioning as the body faculty. So it's just one cell, but that is the seed of the body. And so it's functioning like the physical body. It's sensitive to the tactile sensations of its environment. But as it starts to divide and subdivide and subdivide, very simple, eyes will appear, ears will start to take shape, hands and legs will emerge, nose will emerge, the mouth will take shape, tongue will start to develop. And so through these sense organs, as they're developing, at least the capacity for experience, different types of sensory experience will emerge. Okay, so now the text continues and it says, the mother then carries the embryo in her womb for 9 or 10 months with much anxiety as a heavy burden. You know, now we have modern methods of giving birth, parturition, of giving birth. But in ancient India, as in much of the ancient world, when a woman became pregnant and was, as the pregnancy advanced, there was always a question, is she going to survive the pregnancy or not? Or will she survive the birth process or not? And probably a fairly large percentage of, both maternal deaths and natal deaths? Is that the expression? Okay, so then at the end of 9 or 10 months, the mother gives birth, again with much anxiety as a heavy burden. And then when the child is born, she nourishes it with her own blood. For the mother's breast milk is called blood in the Noble One's discipline. It's a very powerful statement, because we always think of the blood as being the essence of a person's life. And I guess it's from the blood that transmits to the breasts the basic biochemicals that go into the production of milk. And so the breast milk is the mother's, in a sense, it's the mother's own blood that she's using to nurture her child. Okay, so now, over time, the child grows up and his faculties mature. Okay, so now the sense faculties are starting to develop. And so the child plays at various games. Okay, here the text mentions the kind of games that children would play in ancient India in the Buddha's time. Maybe some of them we still have with us. Toy plows, you know, it was an agricultural culture, so they would play plowing the field. Nowadays, you know, children, they like to play doctor and nurse, tip cat, I don't know what that is, somersaults, toy windmills, toy measures, toy cars. Do they have cars in ancient India? Toy bows and arrows. Okay, so in our culture, they'll have little kids will have baseball bats, football, basketball. The really younger ones, unfortunately, they have toy guns and rifles and fighter planes. Okay, so then when the child grows up and his faculties mature still further, now the youth enjoys himself provided and endowed with the five chords or five kinds of sensual pleasure, that is, with forms cognizable by the eye, sounds, odors, flavors, and tactile sensations. So here we're reaching the point now, this is sort of illustrating how through the six sense faculties, contact is taking place. And then as one makes contact with the different sense objects, one is experiencing feelings. And these feelings are described, the kind of sense objects are described as those that are wished for, desired, agreeable, and likable, those that give pleasant feeling. And these are connected with sensual desire and rajaniya. Maybe provocative of lust is too strong. Now I use the word tantalizing or exciting. Okay, so this could be taken to illustrate the stages of dependent origination from the sense faculties through feeling. The six sense faculties, contact, and feeling. Okay, so now with the next section, section number 30, we're going to see how from the arising of feelings, craving will set in and then start once again the process of causation that will produce another turn in the cycle of existence. Okay, so on seeing a form with the eye, he lusts after it, or he becomes attracted to it and attached to it, if it is pleasant, and he dislikes it if it is displeasing or unpleasant. So he abides with mindfulness of the body unestablished. He doesn't set up mindfulness, and he has a limited mind. The mind is limited by the ideas that the way to happiness, to true enjoyment, is just through the indulgence in sensual pleasures. And he does not understand, as it actually is, the deliverance of mind and deliverance of wisdom, where those evil or bad, unwholesome mental states cease without remainder. Okay, so now that he's experiencing pleasant objects, displeasing, unpleasant objects, he becomes engaged in what is called favoring and opposing, or maybe more simply we could say liking and disliking, or attraction and repulsion. So this is the way the ordinary mind functions when it experiences whatever kind of object it be through the senses. It's always drawn towards the pleasant and repelled, turned away by what is unpleasant. Okay, now comes the statement, a little bit interesting. He says, whatever feeling he feels, whether pleasant or painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, he delights in that feeling, welcomes it, and remains holding to it. Okay, normally we could see how one can take delight in pleasant feeling, but how can one take delight in painful feeling or neutral feeling? What do you think?
He identifies, cherishes. People can have very unpleasant feelings and really identify with them.
Yeah.
Kind of cherishing it.
Yeah. So some people, they like, almost they like to undergo kind of feelings of misery, deprivation.
Yeah.
It gives them some kind of sense of maybe self-importance. Andre?
I think it just reinforces the sense of self.
Yeah.
That everybody's attached to.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much that's what Tracy said, yeah. That he sort of strengthens his sense of identification. Yeah, so it's kind of an interesting observation from the standpoint of psychology.
Another thought I had is sometimes it's just hard to leave the mind, not that we delight in it, but it touches the mind and we just can't get rid of it.
Yeah, that's also true. Sometimes these sort of bitter feelings sort of just persist in the mind. And it isn't so much that one delights in it, but one does remain holding to it, and that it becomes difficult to let go of those disagreeable feelings. Any other thoughts about this?
In the case of neither pleasant nor unpleasant, that situation in life where if one doesn't understand someone else's reaction, they insist it must not exist, or that again, that idea of holding.
Yeah, I didn't quite understand.
Why are you so upset? Why does this upset you? Or why do you value this so much? Mm. That, again, it's a way of proclaiming yourself as the measure.
So this is the person who's
the
criticizing the other.
Well, I'm thinking, how do you delight in a state that's neither pleasant nor unpleasant?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think it must be that situation where someone obstinately insists this is not a problem, or this is not to be delighted.
So that's from the perspective of the person who is criticizing somebody else, is that it?
Right, or just not even necessarily criticizing, but affirming their own view.
Yeah, yeah.
In a way.
Okay, maybe. Yep. Richard?
Yeah, I think the idea is that it's something that one can afford to ignore. As you say, I don't have to pay any attention to this, so you can blot it out.
Mm-hmm.
So you, it's just you can blot it out. You don't need to understand it.
Yeah.
So you think it's you treat things that you feel as either pleasant or unpleasant as simply non-existent, not actually part of the world.
Yeah. How about if any of you, have you ever gone through really painful, maybe painful illness? You have a throbbing headache or terrible sore throat, and it subsides and you just return to the bland world of the everyday, and then it seems wonderful, right? Then you start thinking, how is it that I never really appreciated this? We think of a person, maybe this is the typical, what they call the couch potato. You know, nothing really exciting is going on, but he's just sitting on the couch with his remote in his hand, flipping through the television stations. Anything good on? Click, click, click. How's this program? No, click, click. And so it's just kind of dull sense of peace and security, but it's a comfortable state, so he holds on to it. Okay, so then the text continues. Okay, as whatever feeling he feels, here it's translated, he delights in that feeling, he welcomes it and remains holding to it. Okay, as he does so, delight arises in him. Actually, this would be probably a stronger degree of delight than what is called the delighting in that feeling. And then the text says, now delight in feelings is clinging. So this delighting in feelings, we could actually say what's called, okay, whatever feeling he feels, pleasant, painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, he delights in that feeling, he welcomes it. Maybe that much seems to be the working of tanha, or craving. And then holding to it, I would actually say when he remains holding to it, that is really what is the clinging. So now we're moving from the craving, which is seeking delight in feeling. So maybe another idea occurred to me in relation to painful feeling is that, of course, in one way you could say one delights in painful feeling in certain situations, but the mind naturally seeks pleasant feeling. So when one experiences the painful feeling, then one wants to escape from it. And normally the way one tries to escape from it is by finding sources of pleasant feeling. You know, so maybe that's why people like exciting spectacles so much. Um, or the neither painful nor pleasant feeling is just a sort of dull feeling of everyday life. And so, you know, people have the expression TGIF, thank God it's Friday, because Friday, up Monday to Friday is the work week, so you always have to do work. Then when Friday afternoon comes, we're free, we can go out and enjoy ourselves. And so then that sort of feeling on Friday evening when one leaves the work, that could be the sort of seeking delight and feelings. But poor Kaiti, for her it's, thank God it's Monday, because she works Saturday and Sunday and gets Tuesday and Wednesday off. Okay, so this then seeking delight, turning to pleasant objects of the senses, that is the working of tanha or craving. And then this is followed when one acquires the objects of craving, then there comes the holding to them or the attachment to them. And that is upadhana, that is clinging. Okay, then when there is the clinging to the sources of pleasant feeling, then one starts engaging in various activities, either based to protect the objects of clinging, or else to find new sources of pleasure and enjoyment, new activities based on craving. And all of this is now building up fresh karma. One is engaging in new activities. The activities are driven by will or volition or intention, and it's these intentional activities that are creating karma, and this karma is building up or constructing the prospect for a new future existence, a future existence which will be the receptacle or the field for the ripening of one's present karma, one's new karma. And then when this life comes to an end, then with that, those karmically constructive activities as condition, then there takes place birth. And then with birth as condition, there takes place aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. And so such is the origin of the whole mass of dukkha, of suffering. Okay, then the same thing, basically, it's this whole paragraph, number 30, is unfolded or developed based simply on experience through the eye. But then the next paragraph is built up, takes each of the other sense modalities as its basis. And so we have here the six sense bases taken as a whole being our instruments or means of making contact with the world. Contact with the world generates feelings. In quest of pleasant feelings, there arises craving, so which we seek out pleasant experience, and we seek to escape from painful or dull, ordinary experience. The activities rooted in craving, then from craving there comes the clinging to the pleasant experiences and the pushing away of the unpleasant experiences. And then based on this craving and or clinging and pushing away, favoring and opposing, there comes the creation and accumulation of new karma. And then that new karma is what is repeatedly building up, constructing a new stage, a new turn in the round of birth and death. And then with birth as condition, there comes aging and death and so on. Okay, any questions now on this part that we've covered so far? a lot of questions. But first, any coming from the class? Okay. Somebody says, for in vitro fertilization, what happens in the petri dish? See, I think that might be dealt with in Sutta number 50. Or, no, I can't find anything in the guidance. So let me just use my divine eye for a moment. Yeah. In fact, I don't know, but... Okay, let us suppose, okay, there's what's called test tube babies. Okay, so in this case, there's no descent of the embryo into the mother's womb, but probably conception takes place in the mother's womb because that provides a condition for, normal condition for conception to take place. So if, what is done, I mean, I don't really know the science of this, but I think what is just done in the petri dish is to fertilize the egg. Then once the egg becomes fertile and starts to divide, then it's planted into the mother's womb. That's correct. They don't actually develop the whole embryo in the dish itself. And is it always successful or sometimes?
No.
Okay. So what? This is the way I would. This is what I would understand. Okay, the fertilization of the egg is starting to provide a physical condition. So now we have the fertilized ovum, which is just exactly what takes place if it's the mother's season and mother and father have sexual relations. So the egg can get fertilized, and it doesn't necessarily develop into a fetus or an embryo. When it's planted into the, whether it's planted into the mother's womb or whether it's naturally, the egg is naturally impregnated there, whether it's going to develop into a fetus or not depends. One of the conditions is whether or not there is that Gandhava present. So in the case of fertilization in the petri dish, when the ovum is planted into the mother's womb, if there are still suitable physical conditions and if the Gandhava comes, then there will be conception. If either the physical conditions are not right, then there can be a termination of the pregnancy. Or if the physical conditions are appropriate, but the Gandhava is not present, then the pregnancy won't take place, or embryonic development won't take place. Okay, I think this is continuing the question. For in vitro fertilization in the petri dish, the father and mother are not at the scene, and the doctor is almost playing God for the fertilization of the sperm and egg. How does the Gandhava grab the cells? Let's see, Sutta number 59. Nothing there. Okay. I don't think that the Gandhava will grab the cells while it's in the petri dish. I think that the Gandhava is sort of waiting around for the for the ovum to get planted into the mother's womb. That's just my supposition. Okay, based on these cases of past life recall, is the Gandhava some kind of disembodied conscious life energy? Okay, this is interesting and important question, because from the cases that I've read, the Gandhava is not really disembodied, but it's existing in a form body. It has a physical body which is of a very subtle matter, so that we human beings don't see it, but they see themselves as having the body, a body which they identify as being the same body as that of the being that they were in the life that just came to an end. You know, so if, like, I were to pass away now, heart attack, my Gandhava separates, I'll still be wearing the monk's robes with the rust-colored sweater. I'll still, well, I don't think that they have mirrors in that realm, but I look at my hands, still the hands look the same, feet, legs look the same. So they still identify, I'm still the same person, but it's a kind of subtle matter, or maybe it's just a mentally created type of form, but they identify themselves as having a body. Okay, can the Gandhava be taken as the same as the Hindu Atman? The Hindus consider the Atman as being unchanging, but the Buddhists don't accept an eternal existent like the Atman. I don't think that the descriptions of the Gandhava that we find in these rebirth cases really correspond to that of the Atman. The Atman is taken to be something which is infinite, formless, indescribable, inconceivable. But this is no more indescribable or inconceivable than our ordinary physical body and life process. It's just that it's disconnected from the ordinary physical body. Well, many questions here about the Gandhava. Okay, does the Gandhava contain the memories of the life? If not, then how is recollection of past life possible? Okay, the Gandhava, again, almost nothing is said about this in the Buddhist texts, but in these cases that I've read about, as I said, the Gandhava identifies itself as being the same as the person who's passed away, so they must have some memories of the life that has just come to an end. And in some way, the memories of the previous life are imprinted on the stream of consciousness, so they're always potentially available to recall. But once, what happens when, perhaps probably is at the moment of conception, or when that Gandhava connects with the newly fertilized ovum, that at that point all of the conscious memories get obliterated. This might be like in Plato's myth of, I forgot the name of the myth, but Plato or Socrates through the voice, Plato through the voice of Socrates describes what happens to the souls after death, and they become disconnected from the body, and they go to a kind of celestial realm. Does anybody remember the name of that realm? It's almost like a paradisical realm, and they remain there sort of enjoying themselves for a certain period. Then they sense a calling to come back down to an earthly rebirth or reincarnation, and before they're able to come down, they have to drink the waters of the river of Leith. Excuse me? Yeah, it's Leithi, yeah. And so this is the river of the waters of forgetfulness. When they drink of these waters, they lose all of their memories of their previous life, their experience in this celestial realm, and they begin life with apparently a blank state. But all of those past life memories are imprinted on the stream of consciousness. So with suitable development, sometimes it happens spontaneously that people will have rebirth memories. But it's also said that those who develop very deep states of samadhi meditation are able to bring these past life experiences up to consciousness. Then I would like to know what Bhante thinks about the Gandhava versus the Hindu Atman. Isn't that the boxing match scheduled for next week? The Gandhava in this side of the boxing ring, the Hindu Atman that side, when we ring the bell, they come out fighting. Well, I explained the difference just a few minutes ago. There is only the mind state where all feelings stop. If is jhana the only way that a yogi can experience and verify the benefit of cessation of feeling, thus become a stream entera? This question isn't really connected to the sutta, so I'll pass it up for now. Okay, so let us go back to the sutta. Okay, so the paragraphs that we've just gone through, from descent of the embryo in number 26 up to to the end of paragraph 30, these all show, illustrate in a very concrete way the process of dependent origination, how the life process originates through these causes and conditions, and how it goes on to old age and death. Now, in the next section of the sutta, the Buddha is going to explain, in concrete ways, the cessation of the round of existence, how this process of birth and death is brought to an end, or in other words, how liberation takes place from the cycle of rebirths. Okay, so he says, and it begins, this whole process of cessation begins with the appearance of the Buddha in the world. So here a Tathagata appears in the world. And so he's going to illustrate this through the case of a monk who develops the whole path all the ways up to the stage of arhatship. So the text actually repeats passages from an earlier sutta, so we could just review this very quickly. This is beginning on page 272, paragraph 11. So the Tathagata, that's a Buddha, appears in the world. He teaches the Dhamma, which is good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. Then the householder or householder's son hears the Dhamma, gains faith in the Buddha, decides to go forth into homelessness. Then paragraph 13, having gone forth, he observes all the principles of moral training or the ethical training. This goes through the next page, 274. He's content with the simple requisites. Then paragraph 15, he exercises restraint of the sense faculties. This is an important occasion or important stage of the training, because with this stage, one is not giving way to favoring and opposing through the senses, or through liking and disliking through the senses. But instead, one is guarding the sense faculties so that as one experiences pleasant and painful objects, one keeps guard over the mind to prevent the mind from giving way to craving for the pleasant and aversion or dislike towards the unpleasant. Okay, then paragraph 16 emphasizes the development of full awareness. It's actually mindfulness and full awareness, or clear comprehension in all activities. So that is sort of the application of the meditative mind to one's everyday activities. Then paragraph 17, possessing this noble virtue, this noble restraint of the sense faculties, this noble mindfulness and full awareness, one resorts to a secluded dwelling place. Then paragraph 18 describes how the meditator overcome very concisely. It describes how the meditator overcomes the five hindrances, the barriers to the development of the mind. Then we can go back to our sutta, page 359. Having thus abandoned these five hindrances, the imperfections or corruptions of the mind that weaken wisdom, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, he enters and abides in the first jhana, then moving from one state to another, he enters and abides in the second jhana, enters and abides in the third jhana, enters and abides in the fourth jhana. Now, normally in the sequence that we find in the Majjhima Nikaya, the text would go on from the four jhanas to take what are called the three higher knowledges: the knowledge, the recollection of past lives, the knowledge of the passing away and rebirth of beings, and then the knowledge of the destruction of the asavas, the taints or outflows of the mind. But here, interestingly, the text introduces a variation to show it sort of connects the meditative mind developed by the practitioner with the sequence, the series of dependent origination. Okay, so on seeing a form with the eye, he does not lust after it or crave for it if it's a pleasing form, and he does not dislike it or resist it if it's a displeasing form. He abides with mindfulness of the body established. So he has mindfulness established throughout all of his activities. He has an immeasurable mind because of development of the jhanas. He can a very powerful, strong mind. And he understands, as it actually is, the deliverance of mind. Actually prefer liberation of mind and liberation by wisdom, where those bad, unwholesome mental qualities cease without remainder. And so this implies already that this monk or meditator has developed enough insight to know how to bring about the liberation through wisdom. Okay, so now this actually seems to be describing somebody who is, I want to see this note. Yeah, the text says that the immeasurable mind is a supramundane mind, which means that he possesses the path. So this seems to be describing somebody who's already reached the stage of sotapanna, a stream enterer. So this, though it's not mentioned, this person must have developed insight wisdom to the point of stream entry. Okay, so now he's using this wisdom so that whatever feeling he feels, whether pleasant, painful, or neutral, he does not delight in that feeling, welcome it, or remain holding to it. Okay, as he does not do so, then delight in feelings ceases in him. And with the cessation of this delight comes the cessation of clinging. With the cessation of clinging, cessation of becoming or renewed existence. With the cessation of becoming comes cessation of birth. And with the cessation of birth comes the cessation of aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. Okay, so here we see this phase of dependent origination. Since this is a living person, there are the six sense faculties, contact takes place, feeling takes place. That is inevitable as long as we have this body with the sense faculties. But even though the different kinds of feeling take place, this person, because he has the insight of wisdom, doesn't delight in that feeling. And then as he's doing so, delight in feeling ceases in him. That means the cessation of craving. So there's no more craving. With the cessation of delight comes cessation of clinging. So clinging ceases. With the cessation of clinging, there are no more karmic activities to construct a new round of existence. With the cessation of the karmic activities comes cessation of birth. And with cessation of birth, the ceasing of old age and death, and so on. Okay, so that is developed in the first paragraph in regard to the eye as the mode of sensory experience. The next paragraph repeats the same thing with regard to each of the other five senses. And so then we just come to the very conclusion of the sutta, where the Buddha gives a name to it. He says, "Bhikkhus, remember this discourse of mine briefly as deliverance in the destruction of craving." And then he goes back to that monk who started the discourse with his wrong view. We almost forgot about him, but he's still standing on the sideline. This was the monk Sati, who was saying that the way I understand the teaching of the Blessed One, it is the same consciousness that goes wandering and roaming through the cycle of birth and death. And so the Buddha says, remember this monk Sati, the son of a fisherman, is caught up in this vast net of craving, in the trammel of craving. And then that's the end of the sutta. Okay, any questions or comments? Yes?
Yeah.
But
in Chinese tradition, it only stays for 49 days and it has to go to reborn.
Yeah.
Is there a difference between these two traditions?
Yeah. Actually, the idea that the Gandhava can stay for a certain period of time, this is my own hypothesis. According to the Theravada Abhidhamma commentarial tradition, rebirth takes place instantaneously. But I find that not really acceptable, because it seems to me that for rebirth to take place, there has to be the suitable karmic conditions. And it seems very unlikely that as soon as somebody passes away, all of the karmic conditions are ready with another couple who, just at that time, they have to be having sexual relations for that person to take rebirth. And so it seems to me very unlikely that this is going to happen. So this, and then from what I've read in some of these cases of the people who recollect their previous death and what took place after death, they go about in this state. They don't attach it, because they're not really aware of the passage of time. So they don't attach a time period to the length of time that they've been wandering in this state. But I suppose, my assumption is it could even be several months. I think maybe the Chinese use the 49 days, because it's 7 times 7 weeks, and so it's just considered an auspicious number. Otherwise, one really doesn't have an exact idea how long it's going to take place in the intermediate stage. And so one doesn't know, do we go on doing it, 6 months, 1 year. In fact, in the Sri Lankan tradition, when the ceremony is done after the death, It's done 90 days. You know, 3 months is supposed to be the 3-month alms offering in memory of the dead. Okay, we take first. I was asking Valeria. Valeria.
Question about the karma of the Gandhara.
Yeah.
And its relation to the new parents or person. I guess it would be hard to know, but in the case of a mother having multiple miscarriages or not being able to conceive in this present lifetime, does that have more to do with the mother's karma or the baby's karma?
I would assume it's the mother's karma. That's just my assumption.
Two things. One, for rebirth to be instantaneous, then on August 6, 1945, there would have to be an extra 100,000 babies born or conceived. So you could be able to look at the birth rate sometime.
But to play the advocate for that position, it's not necessarily the case that rebirth will take place in the human realm. So rebirth could take place in other realms.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Okay. The other point is this, that is in the traditional Brahmin families, a wife was supposed to hold her husband's feet every morning and pray to him, to God and the Atman. And so Indian feminists tend to regard the belief in Atman and so on as an instrument of domination. Because secondly, women could not be twice born. They couldn't have gurus and so on. So
they didn't have.
Women could not be twice born.
Yeah.
They couldn't have gurus, or they couldn't have the status of. Right. Secondly, there was the belief regarding the whole of society that once more people, shooters, could not compare themselves in any way, or could not consider their experience as being similar to the experience of twice born people, the upper caste men who were in touch with their Atman. And so it was an instrument of social domination that way to prevent any kind of dispute or reputation coming from people lower down in society.
Yeah.
And so when the Buddha said, "Well, there is no Atman," he's attacking the social whole of that concept, saying meaning. There is nothing to distinguish upper caste men in that sense from anyone else.
Yeah, except that I don't know whether all of these regulations regarding the relations between the Brahmins and the Sudras and between Brahmins, Sudras, and Atman were in place in the Buddha's time. It's quite possible that these were formulated in the laws of Manu and the similar law treatises, which would have arisen. They might have started to take shape earlier, but they reached their final form about that period. Okay, we'll take one more question, then one internet question, and then we'll have to.
One comment you made strikes me as very important to my understanding. You were talking about how we seek pleasure, so in an unpleasant experience, we can seek either something more pleasurable.
Yeah.
I was thinking about the ascetic tradition the Buddha came from, and that sometimes those austerities, people can imbue them with great value.
They
really relish their martyrdom and be very competitive. That the discovery of the middle path it's changed my understanding of what renunciation or sense pleasure, sense restraint means.
Yeah.
It could also mean not taking pride, spiritual pride, austerities.
Yeah. Yeah.
So homelessness can be like an inner homelessness too. You know, not taking not taking birth in your attainments.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm
you said harmlessness or?
I'm saying that when you said that we're always seeking pleasure, we're always seeking new ways to kind of cling to our experience, even our spiritual experience. So that even a great monk could take birth in his own experience, his own attainments, in a way. Yeah, with that, you know, if we take pleasure in them or delight in them,
And also maybe that's another way in which somebody can delight in painful feelings.
Right, you're a martyr. But you can be
the martyrdom is a somewhat different concept, but in Buddhist India, or in India in the Buddhist time, I don't think that there was a concept of martyrdom, of dying to promote the faith, but it was more that one would, the ascetics would subject themselves to intense pain, painful self-mortification, often competitively to see who could endure the harsher, more austere pains. And then they would sort of, in a way, delight in it. You know, I'm not... I used to have a joke when the masochist says to the sadist, hit me, the sadist says no. Okay, why are the hindrances not typically mentioned as the condition for ignorance in conditioned origination? Actually, I think that there is a sutta where the five hindrances are mentioned as the condition for ignorance. This is in the Anguttara Nikaya, in the Book of Tens. It could be the Chapter of Tens, Sutta number 61 or 62. So look there. But I think generally the Buddha begins dependent origination with ignorance rather than the five hindrances, because ignorance is the most fundamental condition, whereas the five hindrances are generally rooted in ignorance rather than the reverse. Though there is a certain degree of reciprocity between them. Okay, we'll have to stop now for the morning, and then we'll have a little discussion after lunch. So we end with the sharing of the merits. So we share the merits with the devas, the buddhas, and with all sentient beings, wishing them to be well, happy, to protect the Buddha's teaching, protect the world, to protect ourselves and others. Akasata chabumata neva naga mahidika punyantam anumoditva chiva. Kantu sasanang akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanang akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mamparang. Eta vatacha mehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Eta vatacha mehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Eta vatacha mehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya bhavagupadaya avicihetato etantare satakayupapanna rupi arupicha sanya sanino dukkha pamuchantu posantu nibbutin. I just want to make an announcement about the next class. There's going to be a little bit of a gap because I have some activities the next two Saturdays, and then after that I have to go to California for 2 weeks. So the next class will be on November 13th, followed by a class on November 20th. And those classes will have to be in the library because there'll be the Venerable Czech Dhammadipa will be having the meditation course here in Funyun Hall. We'll send out the announcement from Duangyan Monastery. If anybody is not on the registration list and wants to register, then please give your contact information to Kaiti in the front. So please note that November 13th, and we will do the next sutta. That will be sutta number 39, the larger discourse at Asapura. Okay, we stand up. Okay, and end with three bows.